A fourth wave of COVID cresting soon. Long COVID sufferers struggling to get help. People still dying. This virus is stubborn. It is natural to be worried, but some public health experts say that actually our capacity to manage COVID is pretty good now, and the future looks much brighter than it did a year or so ago. Paul Griffin is with us today. He's the Director of Infectious Diseases at Mater Health Services and Associate Professor of Medicine at the University of Queensland. And he's well-versed in vaccine clinical trials, among other things. Paul Griffin, welcome back to Life Matters.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Now, Paul, in this first year of this pandemic, we often heard COVID compared to the flu, though, you know, it became clear that it was much more deadly. Is that more of a reasonable comparison now?
Look, I think we do have to look to comparing to other viruses as a point of reference and to explain concepts to people. We also have to appreciate, though, that this is a very different virus. And I like to explain to people that this virus probably has just the right mix of properties to cause the big problems that we've seen it do. I mean, it's highly infectious. It causes mild disease or very little disease in many, so that facilitates its spread, but then still causes severe enough disease in enough people that the impact is very significant. But what we want to do is make sure people understand that with the tools we have now, we can certainly make it more manageable so the impact will become similar to viruses we're familiar with, like the flu, or perhaps even milder infections if we do utilise all of our tools to the fullest capacity.
What about eradication? That was tossed around as an idea at one point. Do you think that's possible?
Look, I guess the one thing we know for certain with this virus is it's unpredictable, so I don't think we can predict the future with any high degree of certainty, but I think the prospect of eradication is one that we really don't think is likely. I think, you know, what a lot of us would think, in my opinion, is that we're going to learn to live with this virus for a very long period of time, but hopefully the impact will successively be reduced. And so while we might continue to see waves of transmission, a little like we're experiencing now, hopefully they'll become less frequent and of lower magnitude. And so our ability to live with the virus with a lower impact will continue to improve.
So Paul Griffin, if you're saying that you do think we can get to the point where we can manage COVID as well as we manage some of the other less severe respiratory illnesses that we live with, what will it take to get there?
I think the first thing is for people to understand that that doesn't mean giving up or just letting it rip or ignoring it or becoming complacent. But we need to, as I mentioned, use all of our available tools to their fullest capacity. And, you know, the backbone of that is going to be vaccination. And in fact, in my opinion, given the removal of a lot of the other rules, vaccination has, if anything, become more important. And we're going to get improved vaccines. We've seen Omicron-specific boosters now available, and we're going to see additional vaccines, I think, in the next 12 months. But we also have to appreciate that vaccination alone is not going to be sufficient. And a lot of people label this as a vaccine plus strategy. We've got excellent antivirals. We just need to link people in with those who will get the greatest benefit more quickly than we are at the moment. We've got things like long-acting antibody therapies, which can protect people that don't respond to vaccination. But again, we're currently underutilizing those. And then I think there'll be a place for non-pharmaceutical interventions, things like mask wearing, social distancing, and making sure people that are sick stay home for the foreseeable future. And in fact, while some people won't be happy with that, that's essentially what we've been asking them to do for things like influenza for a long time.
Yes, though the appetite for mask wearing, as you say, has really declined, particularly in cities, and the political appetite for mandating it has certainly almost disappeared. Do you think that should be reinstated in some settings?
I don't think a mandate is necessarily the answer, but I think we need to do more to encourage people to wear masks and to educate people about masks. I mean, some people have the expectation that it's going to be perfect, and then when they see people get infected who've worn masks, they say they don't work at all, whereas we know they provide at least some protection, and as part of a comprehensive strategy, they greatly reduce your risk. And if good masks are worn well, they reduce the risk not only to the wearer, but also people around them. And, you know, I think one of the challenges in our country has been we kind of mandated masks, then we celebrated not needing them, and then shortly thereafter we said, well, we want you to wear them again. Whereas really I'd like to encourage a sustained behavioural change where we just continue to encourage them, particularly for high-risk people or in high-risk settings for the foreseeable future, and maybe supply some information about how they do work and how to wear them properly.
And we talked before about the vaccine plus strategy, Paul, that relies on the vaccine bit happening first. How do we boost those flagging vaccination rates? I mean, some people haven't had their third booster.
Yeah, look, again, I think we need a comprehensive strategy there. I mean, I think there's still a lot of misinformation that should be addressed. And, you know, while I think there's been some inroads in providing information about the benefits of vaccination, unfortunately, when people now are weighing up the pros and cons, given a lot of people assume COVID's gone away or is now mild and not an issue, I think the benefits are perceived to be less. And there's been so much discussion about the adverse events, which in actual fact remain quite rare, that a lot of people make the wrong determination when they weigh those factors up. So, again, I think we need really good information. I think we need to look at access as well. A lot of our big clinics have been shut down as the need has declined. And so it is still a bit hard for people to know what vaccine they should get and when and where they should go. And so I think we really need to do a lot more about that education piece. And, you know, as I said, we've got improved vaccines now, the Omicron-specific boosters. And again, while they're not a silver bullet, they're not perfect, they're going to be a really big step forward in our battle with this virus. And I think we just need to try and make sure people know that they're out there and that they do make a big difference.
And so, Paul, in this more optimistic future, what kind of level do you think COVID will take in the rankings of, you know, more and less severe diseases that we manage? Will we be seeing it at the level of the flu, that's the level of kind of risk and worry that we have towards it?
Look, I'd really like to think, and this is perhaps a little optimistic, and I'm certainly not promising this is going to happen by itself, but I'd really like to think we strive for having an impact that's actually less than the flu. I mean, we've got a number of vaccine options, which are probably a little superior in many ways to the flu vaccine. We've got a range of antiviral therapies, which again are probably a little superior to the antivirals we have for the flu. We've got things like those long-acting antibodies I mentioned, which we don't really have for the flu. And so I think if we use all of those tools to their fullest capacity, maybe including some additional vaccines like an intranasal vaccine maybe in the next few months or years that might help a bit more with transmission. I mean, if we continue to use all those things well, I think the expectation could be that, you know, this becomes something that the impact is maybe even less than the flu. But as I say, that's not just going to happen by itself. That's going to take a lot of effort, but I think it's potentially achievable.
Associate Professor Paul Griffin is our guest today, Director of Infectious Diseases at Mater Health Services and Associate Professor of Medicine at the University of Queensland. Your thoughts on how we manage COVID right now in Australia? Our text and line 0418 226 576. So some reassuring news, but still many deaths. Gideon Maravitz-Katz is an epidemiologist at the University of Wollongong. Gideon, hello.
Hi.
Hi. Now, you say we've hit a turning point when it comes to fatality rates of COVID compared to the flu. Tell us about that.
Well, I think whenever we compare COVID-19 to influenza, it's important to take into account the fact that we measure those things in different ways. We measure deaths from COVID-19 very differently to the way that we measured and do measure deaths from influenza prior to the pandemic. And I wouldn't necessarily say that we've reached a turning point exactly. I think what's happened is over time, the death rate from COVID-19 has declined quite a bit. And this is based on some work that myself and colleagues did in 2020, somewhere in the region of one in 100 people who caught COVID died back at the beginning of the pandemic in Australia. Now, it's hard to estimate precisely how much that's declined, but using the recent blood donor seroprevalence antibody data from the Kirby Institute that's just been released, that allows us to estimate how many people have caught COVID this year. And using the number of reported fatalities, we could say that that rate has declined to about one in 1,500 people who have caught COVID in 2022 have died from the disease, which is a decline in the death rate of about 15 times, somewhere between, you know, 90 to 95% reduction overall. And that's probably because of, as Paul was discussing, antiviral therapies, because of vaccinations, because some people have caught the disease and recovered and therefore have some immunity to it, and, you know, a variety of other mechanisms that have substantially reduced the death rate of COVID-19. And while it's hard to, as I said, it's hard to compare influenza to COVID like to like, but that is a death rate that is very similar to what we would see for seasonal influenza prior to the pandemic.
But I mean, it's still a lot of deaths, isn't it? I mean, it's been a big killer of Australians this year. Does that mean it's still an urgent public health issue?
Yeah, so I think this is the key point, which is that a disease that is substantially more infectious, even if it has a similar risk to the individual, will have a much bigger public health impact. And that's what we've seen with COVID. Influenza this year has not killed nearly as many people as COVID, even though you could argue that the death rates are quite comparable, because far fewer people caught flu than COVID. And I think moving into the future, what's important to recognize is that COVID is likely to be a big public health problem, even if it's not quite as worrisome to the individual. So if you catch COVID as one person, you can have Paxlovid or other antiviral therapies. You can have monoclonal antibody therapies. You are vaccinated, so you're much less risk. And therefore, to the individual, the risk is lower. But to the whole of society, it's still a big problem if everyone gets sick at the same time.
Yes, indeed. And some people are more vulnerable than others. When you talk about that individual risk being much lower, that's unequally distributed, isn't it? Who is most vulnerable, Gideon?
Oh, absolutely, yes. What we showed in our research through several publications is that the biggest risk factor for COVID-19 is age. So someone who is 20 years old, irrespective of comorbidities or other issues, is at a very, very substantially reduced risk when compared to someone who's 60 or 80 years old. There are also other comorbidities and problems that can increase your risk of COVID-19, like diabetes and heart disease. So of course, if you are, say, immunocompromised, or if you have severe health issues prior to COVID, then you are at an increased risk. But the biggest single risk factor for COVID-19 hospitalization and death is age.
And vaccination status, how does that play into that?
Well, yes. So barring medical intervention. So if you're vaccinated, very, very substantially lower risk. It's always better to be vaccinated than not. But if you don't take into account all of the various interventions we have to reduce the severity of COVID-19, that's what I was referring to. But yes, everyone who's vaccinated is at much lower risk than those who are not.
Yes, and that is definitely a theme that's emerging from what you're both saying here today on Life Matters. We've been hearing from Gideon Meyerowitz-Katz, who's an epidemiologist at the University of Wollongong. His recent research looks at COVID fatality rates, and Associate Professor Paul Griffin, Director of Infectious Diseases at Mater Health Services, about the landscape, really, of how we live with COVID today and what it might look like in coming years, because as we have seen, the landscape can change quite a lot from month to month. Paul Griffin, has COVID become more mild as we get successive variants, or are we just getting better at dealing with it and it's those factors that Gideon mentioned that are helping our capacity to cope with it?
Look, it's probably a little bit of both. I mean, what's clear is, Delta had a very significant impact, was probably more severe. And then when we compare Omicron to Delta, that severity was probably reduced. But I think it's still a mistake to label COVID as mild and to just assume it's going to evolve away into something that's of no significance. Because, these changes that we see, these properties that make us talk about these different variants and subvariants are quite random. So the next variant or subvariant that poses big problems may in fact be more severe again. And that's why we have to rely on these strategies that we've discussed moving forward to minimise the impact. And we can't just assume COVID is mild, insignificant, or is going to fade away by itself.
And does it have a cumulative impact on your immune system if you get it more than once? Is that worse than only getting it once?
There's a lot of discussion here, and I think we haven't reached a consensus in terms of the evidence. And, we know people can be reinfected, and when there are subvariants that have changed, like we're seeing at the moment, the risk of reinfection perhaps goes up. And, we know people do get some boost in their immunity from being infected, and that's the basis for this so-called hybrid immunity we're discussing a lot. We certainly don't want to recommend people go and try and get infected because, each infection carries a risk of people getting significant disease. And, some have suggested that successive infections may be milder as you do benefit from that protection from past infection. But that's not to say that a repeated infection can't be severe. And we've certainly seen countless examples of that. And some evidence is emerging that there is a cumulative impact. And, maybe even things like long COVID become more likely with repeated infections. So it's still certainly worthwhile doing all the things we can to prevent getting infected. And that includes vaccination as well as those non-pharmaceutical things, including like mask wearing.
And you mentioned before that idea of hybrid immunity, the level of vaccination within the community and also the level of previous infection within the community. At one point, there was talk that we might reach herd immunity. How likely is that on the current evidence?
Look, I think true herd immunity, where, you know, basically everyone's protected because there's enough people immune in the population that those that can't respond to be protected are sort of surrounded by people that are protected, so there's no concern there, it is not going to be achievable. And, you know, we know that's likely for a few reasons. I mean, we're seeing the virus change so much, and that has an impact on people's immunity, and that's where things like reinfection and immune evasion become relevant. But, you know, also our vaccines perhaps don't provide high enough protection against infection for that to truly be the case. And, you know, that's not detracting from the significance of our vaccines. The protection against severe disease is absolutely amazing and responsible for why we're seeing such high case numbers but few people in ICU. And while the deaths are still higher than we like, relatively speaking, less impact in terms of mortality. So I don't think we'll ever achieve true herd immunity, but that's where coming back to this vaccine plus strategy where we use all of our available tools to minimise the impact is so important.
And Gideon Mayrovitz-Katz, a lot of people are going to be wondering about the relative severity of infection in children compared to adults. What do we know now after, you know, we've had a few years to look at how that plays out?
Yeah, so in general, it's hard to talk about children under the age of five, or at least I'm not an expert in very young kids. But in general, what we find is that the severity of infection for children is much, much lower than for adults. And you see that across death rates, hospitalization rates, and incidence of severe disease, so markers of ED attendances and similar things.
That's very good to know. Gideon, seems to be a bit of disagreement too about how many people have actually had COVID. I mean, how do we know how many people have had it, and why is it important to know those figures?
Yeah, so the main way that we know how many people have had COVID is by testing antibodies. Because it's a novel disease, if you test people and they come up with antibodies, then they are almost certain to have had the disease, or at least that was the case before we started vaccinating people. Before we started vaccinating people, the only way to have antibodies to COVID-19 was to catch the disease. Now, you can have antibodies to COVID-19 by being vaccinated. That's kind of the point of the immunization. However, there are two kinds of antibodies. You have antibodies to the spike protein, and you also have nucleocapsid antibodies. And usually, or the vaccines we've used in Australia at least, only cause people to have spike antibodies, and they don't cause people to have nucleocapsid antibodies. So what you can do is test people for these nucleocapsid antibodies, and if they are positive, the most likely explanation is that they've had COVID-19. And the Kirby Institute released some data recently in collaboration with a number of other institutes like Lifeblood on blood donors across the country. And what they found was that somewhere in the range of 60% of the people in this study who were blood donors had had COVID since February 2022. And that's not a perfect, it's not a perfect example, or it's not a perfect representation of Australia, because of course there's some bias in who goes to give blood and some bias in the way that the study was run. However, I think it's a reasonable estimate based on a variety of factors for the number of people who've been infected since the beginning of the year.
And is it useful to know the numbers of people who've been infected because it helps give you a sense of how widespread that hybrid immunity might be?
Yeah, well, it's useful for many reasons. I mean, the reason that I can estimate with some certainty the death rate for people who catch COVID in 2022 is because we know, again, with some degree of certainty, how many people have had the disease in this year, and we know how many people have died. So it's useful to see how severe the disease currently is. It's useful to know how many people are immune. It's useful to be able to plan for the future, because you can say, well, 60% of people have had a recent infection. We know that the majority of Australians have had at least two doses of a vaccine, and I believe it's 75% of people over the age of 16 have had a booster shot. How can we get the remaining people boosted, and what does that mean for 2023? Very important information on all of those points.
Yes, indeed. Our guest today, Gideon Mayrovitz-Katz, who's an epidemiologist at the University of Wollongong, and Associate Professor Paul Griffin, Director of Infectious Diseases at Mater Health Services. Gideon, there are still a lot of immunocompromised people who don't want to or feel unable to leave the house because of fear of getting COVID. What's the outlook for them in coming years?
I try very hard not to predict the future, because as the famous saying goes, it's the hardest thing to predict. But I think in general, we know the severity of COVID-19 has greatly decreased. I think The challenge, of course, for people who are immunocompromised is that diseases in general are far more worrisome. And I think that, as Paul has said, people adopting non-pharmaceutical interventions into the future certainly provides a great deal more protection for those immunocompromised people, not just for COVID, which, as we've said, may have been reduced quite substantially, but also for a range of other diseases. I mean, the point is that people who are immunocompromised are at risk from every infectious disease, not just the one that we've been worried about recently. So, I mean, I don't know exactly what's going to happen for people who are at higher risk of infection. And I think that it's a difficult question to answer, but with our vaccinations, with our better treatment, and with some measure of masking and other non-pharmaceutical interventions, hopefully the future looks quite good. I do think that masking and similar interventions are likely to continue in hospitals and high-risk settings for a very long time, which is probably a good thing.
Well, the sense I'm getting from both of you is that there's a lot of hope and a lot of possibility for a landscape and outlook where we can manage this disease if, and that's a big if, you know, we can get the right public health measures in place. Paul Griffin, let's look at some of the new vaccines. You mentioned before there's nasal sprays being developed. What could that mean? Could that mean we just get a nasal spray in future instead of an intramuscular jab?
Look, it's really exciting. And of course, you know, the vaccines that are already in use have been an amazing advancement in medical science and have worked tremendously well. But they're perhaps not quite perfect. And, you know, one of the properties we'd really like to see maybe a little bit better, at least, is the ability to block infection in the first place. And it's not necessarily a new strategy. We've tried intranasal vaccines for things like the flu in the past. They've had sort of mixed results, but there's a lot of really good research into an intranasal or an inhaled vaccine for COVID. The evidence is looking like it won't replace the intramuscular vaccines, but as an additional booster, hopefully because it's given via the same route the virus gets in, we'll get a bit better protection at that interface and maybe help at least a little bit in terms of stopping infection in the first place. And, you know, a vaccine like that will have, I think, a big impact on the total numbers of cases we see, and then obviously the consequences as well.
Well, and when we speak about boosters, what's the future going to be like, do you think? Are we going to need a booster or maybe even two every year?
Yeah, again, it's a little bit like predicting the future. I think that the one thing that we know for sure is that, you know, even with 3, 4, or 5 vaccines, as some people have had, that's not going to protect people lifelong. So future doses will be required. But exactly when and what vaccine that is still remains to be seen to a large degree. I personally think we'll get to a stage where on the balance of a number of factors, it becomes something we do annually. And there's some great work combining vaccines at the moment. So there's flu and RSV and flu and COVID and just flu and COVID vaccines. It'll probably be available next year as well. The trouble there is knowing the best time to use those type of combined vaccines, because COVID's not going to mirror the same seasonality we see with some of those other infections. But yeah, I think it'll probably get to a stage where we have maybe 1 or 2 doses a year. But as I say, lots of variables that are still to be determined there.
Yes, I'm holding tight to your hope that it will eventually get to the level of management of like the common cold, that we will find it an annoying but hopefully not a fatal thing very often in our community. But Paul Griffin, the WHO announced the other day that the end of the pandemic is in sight, and there was a lot of excitement about that. How do we know when it will be over?
Yeah, look, good question. And that was a really exciting announcement. Unfortunately, a lot of people lost the context there and thought that was a signal the pandemic's kind of over already. And, you know, I think it was a really great statement they put forward that the finish line is in sight. But, you know, as you do in a marathon, what you do is you increase your efforts to get over the line. You don't just give up and stop to get there. So I think that was a call to arms, essentially, to make sure people do all the things we've been discussing. And a lot of people saw that as an indicator that they could stop. And so in terms of when that declaration happens, I mean, there'll be a really large number of variables that'll be considered in terms of, you know, case numbers, what variants are circulating, the impact in terms of hospitalizations, intensive care and death, for example. And, you know, I think that the biggest danger for us is just assuming the virus is going to do that all by itself and not using all of our interventions. I think if we do more, and that includes not only in our country, but, you know, the equitable distribution of some of those interventions like vaccines to a number of countries that haven't had the opportunity like we have, will be a huge part of hopefully achieving that goal relatively soon.
Yep, there's a lot of hope and a lot of caveats that come out of this conversation today. Thank you both so much for your time, Paul Griffin and Gideon Mayrovitz-Katz.
It's a pleasure.
That's my pleasure.
Thank you. Associate Professor Paul Griffin is the Director of Infectious Diseases at Mater Health Services and Associate Professor of Medicine at the University of Queensland. And Gideon Mayrovitz-Katz is an epidemiologist at the University of Wollongong who's been looking at what the data on fatality rates from COVID can tell us.
It's easier than ever to hear your favourite local and national ABC radio stations live and on demand on the ABC Listen app.